Recording. Okay, over to you.
Okay. Well, hello, friends. Welcome to this 80th webinar on the Secret Doctrine. This webinar series is available on makara.us under the subheading Mori Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress. All episodes of this, the Secret Teachings of All Ages, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you'd like to catch up on. You can also access any of these webinars on the homepage of moriafederation.com. So if you misplaced your invitation, just go to moriafederation.com, and this is all the webinars that series that are in current are listed here. Okay. This month, in Old Diary Leaves, Colonel Olcott describes his correspondence with HPB, who's now in London. Could we get a reader, please?
Whoops. Okay, I'll start.
Okay.
In answer to my protest against her taking up the editorship of the projected new magazine, Lucifer, while still nominally editor of The Theosophist, T assures me most earnestly that it shall never be allowed to hurt our magazine, but will be rather a supplement to it. And sent me a joint note from the founders of the Theosophical Publishing Company that the schemes emanated from members of the London Lodge who wished to see the movement active in England, Europe, and the West generally, and circulate the teachings which had been given them. She wrote me that to start Lucifer and publish the Secret Doctrine, Theosophical Publishing Company, with a subscribed capital of £1,500 had been formed and registered. As regarded her return to India, he had no heart for it if Subbarow was to be her enemy. So much had she loved and respected him. And besides, it had been reported to her through third parties that if she returned, the government would send her to prison on some paltry pretext.
Yikes. Okay, next.
Need another reader?
Yeah, please.
Vivian, will you read that for us, please?
This was the sheerest nonsense, but she did not realize it. So positive had been the correspondence, not Hindus, of course, of her informants. So there she was, hoping and yearning to be allowed to come back to, as she writes, at least die in India, yet unable to get out of her London engagements, torn by conflicting emotions, made almost wild by the tone of my letters, which were sometimes very harsh, as I too had enough to drive a more nervous man crazy, and suffering from mortal diseases which made life a burden. Yet through all, like the faithful sentinel of Pompeii, she stuck to her duty, passed many of the 24 hours at her desk, reconciled enemies, made new friends enthusiastic, and little by little poured into receptive minds the sublime teachings of which she was the channel. Ah, cruel world, when shall you have another Helena Petrovna to martyrize?
Thank you, Vivian. Okay. We began our last session by taking a look at the diagram that appears on page 200 of volume one, which was redrawn, shown here, by the Gutenberg Project, the inventor and first provider of ebooks back in 1971. And which is one of the first charts, maybe the first, to depict the seven subplanes of the cosmic physical plane. You can see them here. This chart depicts the seven globes of a chain, globes A through G, and directly associates these globes with the seven inferiors, sephira, of the Kabbalistic tree of life. The chart combines linear levels of progressive density for the planets and the circular cyclical movement of the seven planets of a chain as they pass through each round, though it doesn't include the change in density of the planets as they move from round to round, as shown here. HPB then compares the seven subplanes of the cosmic physical plane to the seven principles in man, shown here at right. These seven principles are also called the Saptaparna, or seven-leaved plant, symbolized by the triangle above the square. We then studied the concept of the world germ, the eternal seed at the root of every atom of consciousness, each of which is eventually destined to become a celestial being. We then learned about the psychometrist Elizabeth Denton, who used psychometry to explore such topics as ancient Egypt, India, China, Greece, Rome, the psychometry of metals, gems, etc., of this human body and soul, the psychometry of the Bible, the Quran and the Vedas. So she would, for instance, hold up a Bible and then be able to have visions of time and place based on these objects or time periods or religions. Pretty extraordinary woman. Then she and her husband wrote about them. HPB then turns to the subject of cosmic desire, desire which manifests, which is made possible through Fohat, which is intelligent electricity. It binds spirit and matter. This leads to an exegesis on the higher and lower realms of light and dark. Quote, cosmic desire evolves into absolute light. Now, light without any shadow would be absolute light. In other words, absolute darkness. So it's just called darkness because those of a lesser level of consciousness are not able to perceive it. And a question and answer with B. Keightley, who's a learned scholar. HPB extemporaneously expands on the subject of light and dark, saying, for example, he, Eros, who is now the god of human love, was simply an abstract idea, an image of the divine creative force, that universal force of attraction which causes particles to congregate, combine, and correlate, and to produce a triad. Well, that creative force is our Fohat, who neither creates nor does he produce anything per se by himself, but in virtue of his action, elements as well as beings seek to unite in polarity, for which unison results life. That's actually a really good definition of Fohat. And this takes us up to where we left off last time. So we'll start this session by rereading this passage from page 201, looks like. Could we get a reader, please?
Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, I can. Thank you. Verse 6, shall I read with the pink or the central?
No, you never read, always the central.
Okay. Or as the occult teaching expresses it, quote, the central sun causes Fohat to collect primordial dust in the form of balls to impel them to move in converging lines and finally to approach each other and aggregate, unquote, Book of Zion. Being scattered in space without order or system, The world germs come into frequent collision until their final aggregation, at which they become wanderers, comets. Then the battles and struggles begin. The older bodies attract the younger, while the others repel them. Many perish, devoured by their stronger companions. Those that escape become worlds, unquote. When carefully analyzed and reflected upon, this will be found as scientific as science could make it, even at our late period.
Thank you, Martha. Okay, first up, or as the occult teaching expresses it, the central sun causes foha to collect primordial dust in the form of balls, to impel them to move in converging lines, and finally to approach each other and aggregate, from the Book of Zion. So Fohat is compelled by the cosmic desire to be, which emanates from the central spiritual sun, uses the forces of attraction and repulsion and electricity to, which changes it, each subplane of the cosmic physical plane, the nature of this, of the qualities, to aggregate primordial dust or fire mist into quote unquote fiery balls. These are actually globes eventually, and to become planets. We might be tempted to see this as an astronomical description of solar systemic creation. That's what she says in the footnote. Except for the fact that the process being described is happening in primordial rather than dense physical matter. Decay defines Fohat as, quote, the sum total of that which is active, animated, or vitalized, and of all that concerns itself with the adaptation of the form to the needs of the inner flame of life. Okay, so I urge you to comment, and if you have any questions, please ask questions. These webinars are always more interesting when we have participation. Okay, so next up, I see Ariane. Yes.
Oh, I cannot resist. I really love this passage. I hope I can keep it in mind. I don't know if I mentioned it before, but this idea of orbs, that these orbs are around us all the time and they're reflecting the energy that we vibrate. So they seem to be, this is my hypothesis, it may not be true, but this is how I understand it. That, you know, when we talk about the Akashic records or the fact that our own karma, our thoughts, feelings, and behavior is recorded somewhere and is changing all the entire universe, because everything we have done is in the now, is perpetually being recorded in the library, but also is in the timeless now, then we can think of these orbs as all around us, light dancing, and that they are witnessing and reacting and changing shape and color in response to who we are. Both are, you know, say for instance, my voice now, my tone of voice, which I'm trying to monitor, and the quality of my words, because all words have vibration too. Like all, when that woman who wrote the psychometry books, like she's right, picking up on the energy of something within the book itself, maybe the description of a passage or the person holding the book, I don't really know, but everything is alive. Everything, every atom is yearning towards greater consciousness. And so we are surrounded by that. And then again, it's like a great reminder of the importance, at the very least, of monitoring ourselves, and then hopefully going on to self-observation, and then from there going on to some kind of consciousness exercise which, you know, happens in stages, and there's more than just one form of that. So if you want to see someone on YouTube, someone I actually studied, I took a class with her, Grace Butler, or maybe Diane Grace Butler. She has photographed these lights, these orbs of lights, by just taking some kind of regular digital camera and shining it through a piece of glass. And then it breaks up the light surrounding in the room, or when she plays music, like she played some Louis Armstrong. I don't remember. It was Hello Dolly, I think it was. And when you witness it, then it becomes more real. My talking about it may not have the same impact. So I would really encourage you to consider that. I think it's worthy of your time.
If you can, why don't you put the link in the chat box, and those that are interested can check that out. That would be great. If you have that link to where that can be viewed online. Well, she's specifically talking here about the original formation of planets. And that's what these primordial balls of dust, which are literally on the higher subplanes of the cosmic physical plane, eventually make their way into physical matter, and where they begin to aggregate. So thank you, Ariane. Okay, so next, being scattered in space without order or system, the world germs come into frequent collision until their final aggregation, after which they become wanderers, comets. So without order or system suggests a time before all these many world germs become regulated by the central force of the sun. The term comet, which doesn't appear at all in DK's writings, is a term given to a cosmic life that emerges from a quote-unquote lump of cosmic protoplasm, meaning a pre-matter, you could say, homogeneous and latent. So that's going to be Mula Prakriti, that matter at its undifferentiated state. And then a lump, quote unquote, or a ball, detaches itself, and through a long, long evolutionary process, gathers the elements that will eventually allow it to become a planet. And it's all along this way, it assimilates or accumulates differentiated elements. And then only eventually settles into some system so as to become an inhabitable globe. Obviously, she's not talking about the fully formed dense physical plane comets that science knows to be made up of basically the same differentiated elements that our planets are made of, but rather some primordial version of what will eventually become planets. And this whole process is only described in first generation theosophy. You don't have this particular description in DK theosophy. Next, then the battles and struggles begin. The older bodies attract the younger, while others repel them. Many perish, devoured by their stronger companions. Those that escape become worlds. So this is a natural continuation of the initial phase wherein Fohat, quote, collects primordial dust in the form of balls. To gain more insight on the battles and struggles, we'll again turn to the Secret Doctrine dialogues. Let's actually divide this into two. Let's somebody read up to, let's see, make sure I didn't, no, I didn't. So read up to where my cursor is, consciousness than is the animal, and then we'll pick up another reader. Can we get a reader, please? Are you there?
Can you hear me? Okay, sorry, I'm having trouble with my headset. Can we start, please, with Marguerite and finish up with Ariane?
Okay, so Marguerite, just read up to where my cursor is. Can you see that okay?
Certainly, sure.
Great.
Mr. B. Knightley, in these pages, you distinctly state that even in the higher phases of cosmic evolution, there rages a, quote, struggle for existence, end quote. Now, it is on this struggle for existence, regarded as a universal law, that the materialists base their justification for human selfishness. We would therefore ask, A, where does this struggle for existence cease? One, in reference to the cosmos, two, as regards humanity, and B, how is it that this cosmic law is suspended by that of altruism in the case of human beings? Madame Blavatsky, the struggle for existence rages universally in sidereal as in terrain spaces.
Means earth-like spaces.
This is the first fundamental law in nature, the visible effects of which materialistic science has called correlation of physical forces in matter. But this applies only and solely to differentiated matter. It has nothing to do with individual or even personal units, which ought to be if they are not guided by the higher laws of the upper triad and not by the instinctual impulses acting on the plane of the lower quaternary. The struggle for existence begins with the physical molecules and ends with those animals which are quite irrational. This is therefore no justification for human selfishness, as man is an animal on a higher plane of being and consciousness than is the animal.
Okay, next reader.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
As to the physical cosmos, the struggle will cease only with the coming of Pralaya. With respect to its living and conscious beings, however, the struggle ceases to operate at that human stage where consciousness and reason make their appearance. It is in man alone that the higher divine triad may be fully active. But this triad is trinity in unity, and unity or homogeneity characterizes the plane of its action. In the four lower planes of cosmos, on the contrary, it is the law of diversity and heterogeneity which reign supreme. Hence, those beings who are endowed with a higher triad come under its laws, not under those of the lower quaternary, which act only upon those beings, atoms or things, in which rationality is still an underdeveloped potentiality. Therefore, since the law of being is unity, the higher self in him, it follows that the individual human being can only attain his complete and perfect development by acting in perfect unity, that is to say, harmony with all other men. Now, B, the struggle for existence, which exists today among men, proves only that firstly, man has not yet fully emerged from his savage animal condition. His manas not yet being fully developed in this, our fourth round. For it will be only in the fifth. And secondly, that the great men of learning who proclaim selfishness as the great law of human life are, their learning and intellect notwithstanding, not on a much higher plane themselves. In other words, these learned gentlemen are still animals. Whoever wants to go and tell them, let them. What have you got to say? Are you going to take up the defense of men of learning?
Okay, I hope you get the upshot here, that this law, which is, you know, can be found in Darwinism, you know, survival of the fittest, that idea, you know, when applied to planets through accumulation, the lesser, you know, are subsumed into the greater. All that has to do with form aspect, you know, and this question about the struggle in relation to the selfishness of humanity, that this law applies only to the lower quaternary and to the personality aspect, that on higher levels, this law is not in effect, this the law of the survival of the fittest. Okay, any thoughts or questions about this?
Yes, Peter says, there is no postponement of the effect of gravity once a material body is obtained. And says, I'm sorry, MB, I guess Madam Blavatsky, contradicts Newton.
See, how does she contradict Newton? Yeah, you're right. Once, you know, gravity is a function of physicality. And as long as it functions on, in the lower quaternary, and it's, you know, the laws that govern gravity are part of how planets are formed. There's no question in terms of physicality. That's why she gives us this footnote here, you know, where, when carefully analyzed and reflected upon, this will be found as scientific as science could make it, even at our late period. It's not the same as, but she's relating it to the science of accumulation, which we still have, by the way, that concept. But that on the inner planes, which is where these the protoplasm of the initial accumulation occurs, then you have different forces at work. Okay, anyone else?
Yes, we have a hand. Martha, please go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to say that evolutionary biologists also recognize the limitations of Newton's theory. He, at that time, they thought it applied universally. Now the evolutionary biologists are talking about interrelationship, and they have shown, if a lot of the work came out of Harvard, that the interrelationship, that the microbes that would be described as altruistic according to their own species are the survivors. So we, since Blavatsky, the very thing that she was getting at has been proven. I am so sorry. The A.O. Wilson had a protege who worked began this theory, but many others, and the very popular one is also pointing that out. I just want to go for it.
Why don't you collect that information and put it in the chat? I think some people would be interested in hearing that, if you can, if that works, with A.O. Wilson and any publications along that line, Martha. Also, you got that thing going on with your mic. I don't know if you're handling it or if what's going on there, but we've talked about that before.
I will do that.
Great, thank you. All right, anyone else? What do we have going on in the chat?
Wait a minute. Sorry. I'm having trouble with my headset. Ariane has put the links for Grace Butler lectures and orbs and a couple of other things in there. So everybody can look at that.
Right, okay, yeah. And I see Peter's comment. Okay, well. So the footnote. So the late period that she cites here is the 1880s. Nonetheless, the aggregation theory is still espoused in astronomy, as this paraphrased statement from astronomy.com shows. Quote, planets are initially formed from the gas and dust that surround a young star. These materials gradually clump together and grow larger, forming the building blocks of planets called planetesimals. You know, one wonders if, see, this is, you don't have a direct correlation between what HPP is giving us and this description, because this is on a purely physical level. And HPP suggests that this process starts with proto matter, protoplasm, and that later it comes into the laws that are described here. Over time, these planetesimals collide and merge, creating protoplanets that eventually become full-fledged planets. So you can see the parallel. And this is, you know, right out of astronomy.com. Certainly a well-held theory. The big difference between this description and the secret doctrine is the latter describes the aggregation of primordial rather than dense physical matter. So I saw Peter's hand there.
Yes. Go ahead.
There is no contradiction, as I see it, when we say we have the accretion disk. Let's take the physical plane first. We have the accretion disk in the new sun system. It's all regulated by gravity.
Right.
And where the planetesimals, where the planet lumps accrete and become planets, that is a consequence of something that has already occurred on the higher planes. It's simply a focus that manifests physically. So there, I see no opposition with Newton. What I did react to was that she said, oh, but gravity does not work initially. Gravity rules it all.
The theosophists as a general prefer the law of attraction rather than gravity, but there's, you know, because it functions on all the planes, whereas gravity functions in the material aspect. But that's, thank you for that clarification, Peter. It's appreciate that. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Trudy, can you read that for it, please?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
We have been assured that there exist several modern works of speculative fancy open to struggles for life in sidereal heaven, especially in the German language. We rejoice to hear it, for ours is an occult teaching lost in the darkness of archaic ages. We have treated it fully in Isis Unveiled, and the idea of Darwinian-like evolution of struggle for life and supremacy, and of the survival of the fittest among the host above as the host below runs throughout both the volumes of our earlier work written in 1876, the index in Isis Unveiled at the words evolution and Darwin capilla battle of life. But the idea was not ours. It is that of antiquity.
Thank you. Okay, so first, we have been assured that there exist several modern works of speculative fancy upon such struggles for life in sidereal heaven, especially in the German language. We rejoice to hear it, for ours is an occult teaching lost in the darkness of archaic ages. So one of the books that HPB might have had in mind is the novel Titan by the German author Jean-Paul, which is full of allegorical and mystical references to the cosmic struggle between light and darkness, and the role of human free will and destiny in the divine plan. Or possibly Jacob Bohm's Morgenrot im Aufgang, which is a visionary account of Bohm's own spiritual journey, in which he encounters various celestial beings and witnesses the cosmic drama of the fall and redemption of the divine Sophia, or wisdom. And I'm just now remembering also there's that Bulwer Lytton book, I can't remember the name of it now, where he describes the as part of the novel, the occult formation of the planets. What was that called? Escapes me. Okay.
Francis?
Yeah.
Sorry, we have a question here from Magda. She says, is that astronomical piece talking about the origin of matter, manifestation through the three worlds, mineral, vegetable, and animal, that the lunar petries go through first at globe A of each chain?
Okay, let me look at this chat. Is that astronomical piece? You mean the description given by HPB on the formation of the planets, I guess, or is she talking?
Yes, the information, those five sentences that you copied from an astronomical information.
You mean the
Little piece, planets are initially formed, from the gas. Is this talking about what the lunar petries, Blavatsky says, are the most evoluted monads, meaning that they reach first, before everybody else, the human form on globe A on first round, and they are the ones that guide the human element, because they have gone through the other three inferior worlds, and then they guide the element, the human element, during the second and third round. And so by the fourth round, they have evolved, they are doubles, they are shadows. And for the class, the second class that comes after them, meaning the monads that come after them, the Blavatsky calls them the monads that reach the human stage first during the third and a half round, and then become
root races. Third and a half root races.
Yes. And then the third group are the left behind monads that caused by karmic impediments will never reach the human stage during that cycle or round, except some that she will talk about afterwards, but I haven't reached that point yet. But and she also said that the word men is improper, not proper, because shows clearly that any European language is not able to express this subtle distinction. So, but apart from this, kind of mystery here that I assume, but I am not sure, I assume has to do with the lunar scheme that is the mother of the Earth, where we know there are mysteries that haven't been talked about in Blavatsky. At least I haven't reached that point yet. But I mean, these planets are initially formed from the gas and dust, meaning glob A, you know, like in, I don't know, in Steiner that we say, you know, on at the beginning, it's not human form, till the third globe, till the third globe when we start developing karma. So on Lemu, on this Earth team, and then Atlantis, and now we Aries. He's great. So it has to do with this.
Well, I think this is strictly the mineral kingdom that's being described here. And in terms of astronomy.com, purely physical plane. So this would be globe D of the fourth round. That's only could be described by astronomy. Now we assume that there are parallel developments in the manifestation of the mineral kingdom on the earlier globes, but they wouldn't be the same because they wouldn't be as dense in their final substance. But you know, this idea of clumping together aggregation, I think would probably apply to that, but it doesn't really, I think it's limited just to the formation of the literal uninhabited planet, because the mineral kingdom always comes first, before any of the other kingdoms can transfer the life wave onto the globes that have been formed.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, you bet.
See, Francis?
Yeah.
Look in the chat.
Okay.
Ariana put a image in there. She says, if you look closely, you will see the image of Jesus that appears during this class. I have captured it here. It is a blessing for us. And then she posted the image. Do you see that?
I see the image. Very interesting. Yeah.
I wasn't paying that close attention because I'm trying to do several things at once, but did anybody else see that image when it came through?
How did it come through? I didn't see it. I mean, in what way did it come through, quote unquote, come through?
Well, I can just explain it very briefly. I was taking this class and I was studying the images, and she was showing us hundreds of images of orbs. And so I was just doing screenshots of these images. And then months later, when I went through the images, mixed up with one of them was this image of Jesus on my computer. And you can see it's a zoom shot. And so, you can't really blow it up much or it starts to get distorted. But then when I just started looking for the URLs to help you guys find this, should you be interested, I saw the image come up again right now. It came up as I was looking for the URLs. It came up before for me right now during this class with you, Raul. And I don't know if it was again just a blessing and it happened again secondarily.
Let's call it that. Let's call it a blessing. That sounds good to me. Thanks for sharing that. That's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
And then Martha says, reference evolutionary biology of altruism. The comment is directed to the misdirection of Darwin's intentions regarding natural selection, not Newton's theory of gravity.
Oh,
so she's okay. Just clarifying that.
Okay, good. Thank you, Martha. Okay. And okay, so next, we looked at these. We have treated of it fully in Isis Unveiled, and the idea of Darwinian-like evolution, a struggle for life and supremacy, and of the, quote, survival of the fittest, unquote, among the hosts above as the hosts below, runs throughout both the volumes of our earlier work, written in 1876, Sea Index and Isis Unveiled at the words evolution, Darwin, Capella, Battle of Life, etc. But the idea was not ours. It is that of antiquity. Well, that would be true of pretty much everything she writes. So the it that is treated fully in Isis Unveiled, where she says, I have treated of it fully, is the nature of evolution, both human and cosmological. So I just pulled up one of these index references, the first one on evolution, apropos. So can we get a reader for this excerpt?
Yes, Barbara, can you read that, please? Oops, I guess we lost Barbara. Janet, can you read that, please? Janet?
Evolution. The development of higher orders of animals from the lower. Modern or so-called exact science holds but to a one-sided physical evolution, prudently avoiding and ignoring the higher or spiritual evolution, which would force our contemporaries to confess the superiority of the ancient philosophers and cytologists over themselves, the ancient sages ascending to the unknowable, made their starting point from the first manifestation of the unseen, the unavoidable, and from a strict logical reasoning, the absolute necessity, the absolutely necessary creative being, the demiurgos of the universe. Evolution began with them, with pure spirit, which descending lower and lower down, assumed at last a visible and comprehensible form and became matter.
Yeah, the emphasis here, thank you. The emphasis here is on causality, right? There is no causality on the physical plane. There's just effect, effect of unseen forces. That's her premise, and that's generally the premise of theosophy in general. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Even the Puranic writers have ingeniously interwoven allegory with cosmic facts and human events. Any symbologist may discern the astrocosmical allusion, even though he be unable to grasp the whole meaning. The great wars in heaven, in the Puranas, the wars of the Titans, in Hesiod and other classical writers, the struggles also in the Egyptian legend between Osiris and Typhon, and even those in the Scandinavian legends, all refer to the same subject. Northern mythology refers to it as the Battle of the Flames, the sun, the sons of Muspel, who fought in the field of Vigrat. All this relate to heaven and earth, and have a double and often even a triple meaning, an esoteric application to things above as to things below. They relate severally to astronomical theogonical and human struggles, to the adjustment of orbs and the supremacy among nations and tribes.
Thank you. So first, even the Puranic writers have ingeniously interwoven allegory with cosmic facts and human events. Any symbologist may discern the astrocosmical allusion, even though he be unable to grasp the whole meaning. one famous allegory narrated in several Puranas that describes the formation of cosmos is a story called the churning of the ocean of milk, or Samudra Manthan. In the story, the Suras and the Asuras agree to cooperate in churning the ocean of milk, using the serpent Vasuki as the rope and the mountain Mandara as the churning rod, in order to obtain the nectar of immortality called Amrita. However, the churning also produced many other things, including various celestial beings, planets, animals, plants, jewels, weapons, and poisons. Here's a quite famous and exquisite, I might add, frieze of the subject at Angkor Wat. In the text, HPB says, any symbologist may discern the astrocosmical illusion. A case in point is the fact that the Samudra Mantham can be read on many levels. Macrocosmically, the Suras and Asuras represent the primordial duality of spirit and matter, whose interaction, the churning, produce the manifested universe. But the ocean of milk can also represent the collective human consciousness, which contains both goods and evil tendencies. In other words, it's a primary metaphorical language that can be used at different level, represented by the powers and qualities that appear in the ocean. The mountain Mandara is the, and here it is shown, is the axis or spine of the world. And it channels the life force into the manifested realm. The serpent Vasuki is the Kundalini, whose activity results in liberation. You can also see here the tortoise, which represents the root chakra of existence. I think it's also can be found. Yeah, you see it here also. Any thoughts or questions? Comments? Okay, next.
I don't see any at this time.
All right. The great, quote, wars in heaven in the Puranas, the wars of the Titans in Hesiod and other classical writers, the struggles also in the Egyptian legend between Osiris and Typhon, and even those in the Scandinavian legends all refer to the same subject. So Hesiod's Wars of the Titans depicts the shift between the old order of gods represented by Cronos and the new order represented by Zeus. At least that's one of its applications. HPB tells us that the Titans are associated with the first three root races, the Polarian, the Hyperborean, and the Lemurian, whereas the Olympians are associated with the fourth and fifth root races, the Atlantean and the Aryan. The war, called also the Titanomachy, marked the end of the Atlantean root race, which was corrupted by the abuse of the psychic powers inherited from the Titans. The same struggle is referenced in the enmity between Osiris and Set, or Typhon. You may remember from secret teachings of all ages that Typhon killed Osiris and cut his body into pieces, which he scattered across Egypt. Then Isis searched for the pieces, reassembled them with the help of Anubis. She then used her magic to revive Osiris and conceive a son, Horus. As HPB implies, the meaning of this story is similar to the Titanomachy. Osiris is the personification of the divine principle, the source of all life and intelligence, and the ruler of the underworld, where the souls of the dead are judged and purified. Typhon, or Set, is the personification of the material principle, the source of all evil and ignorance, and the enemy of Osiris, who tries to destroy his body and usurp his throne. But in this story, it is Horus, as progeny of Osiris and Isis, of spirit and matter, that represents the potential liberation of the fifth root race. Next, Northern Mel. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, we have a hand.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, please, Ariane.
Oh, it was a little while back, but I hope you can help me here. We had one of these classes, and one of these classes, you mentioned that the Asuras are not bad. Right. Would you just quickly define what your understanding is of the Asuras and the, what is the other one? The non-Asuras?
Asuras. Yeah, Asuras and the Asuras. Asuras are gods. Asuras are actually, esoterically, they're the source of the gods. They're the primal elementals. Satan, in one of our webinars, she's talking about how Satan was the host of the Asuras, who refused to incarnate in order that they may help humankind develop their higher vehicles. For instance, the Abhabhuti Manasic vehicles. Whereas the Asuras followed the law, which was the will to be of deity, and became the imprisoned souls of humanity. But in Christianity, they were vilified. In fact, also in other cultures, including Egypt, where Typhon, who really was an Asura, was vilified and became the material principle or the personification of evil. But the truth is, this is a demon, demon est inversus, the reversal of the high and the low, which the church still very much puts forward, through the idea of hell and the devil and Lucifer, who is a great being of light. So yeah, that's them in a nutshell. The Asuras are causal and higher form of beings. Okay.
And then Magda says Saturn, Kronos, father, birth, logos, and Zeus, Jupiter, sun, second logos, first and fifth globe, are right now astrologically pressing into a sandwich, the Earth fourth globe. I hear, she says.
Well, interesting. Okay. I'm not sure what to say about that, but thank you. Okay, next up. Northern mythology refers to it as the Battle of the Flames, the sons of Muspel, who fought on the field of Vigrid. So interestingly, this Norse version of the war in heaven takes place in the future, at the end of the world. Here's the story in a nutshell. The sons of Muspel are the fire giants who live in Muspelheim, the realm of fire, under the leadership of Surtr, the fire demon. They are the enemies of the gods and the forces of order. Interesting. At the time of Ragnarok, the sons of, that's the great war that will happen in the future, the sons of Muspel will break the Bifrost Bridge, the rainbow bridge that connects the world of the gods, Asgard, and the world of humans, Midgard. They will then ride through the opening in the sky with Surtr in the front, wielding a flaming sword that shines brighter than the sun. They will join the forces of chaos, such as the frost giants, the dragon Nidhogg, and the wolf Fenrir, in the final battle against the gods and their allies, such as the Valkyries, the Einherjar, and the dwarf and Vari. The battle will take place in the field of Vigrid, which means the plain of the slain. The battle of the flames will be fierce and destructive and will result in the death of many gods and beings. Surtur will kill the god Freyr and then set fire to the world tree, Yggdrasil. However, after the battle, a new and better world will emerge from the ashes, where the surviving god and humans will live in peace and harmony. Perhaps this Nordic version of the war in heaven foretells a fiery fate for this, our fifth root race. At any rate, you can see the similarities in these different traditions. Any thoughts or questions about this?
Not yet.
There's an amazing continuity that occurs between these legends of creation and destruction of the world. Often you can find the same figures represented through different names, but even with similar attributes. Okay, finally, all these relate to heaven and earth and have a double and often a triple meaning and esoteric application to things above as to things below. They relate severally to astronomical, theogonical, and human struggles, to the adjustment of orbs, and the supremacy among nations and tribes. Okay, an example of the esoteric slash astronomical meaning of the Titanomachy, is that Cronus is associated with both Saturn and the last solar system, and Zeus with Jupiter and the current solar system. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Magda, can you read that for us, please?
Struggle for existence and the survival of the fittest.
Magda, can you get closer to your mic? You're quite faint.
Yeah.
Better now?
Yeah, quite a bit.
The struggle for existence and the survival of the fittest. Raiden is supreme from the moment that cosmos manifested into being and could hardly escape the observant eye of an ancient sages. Hence the incessant fights of Indra, the god of the firmament, with Asuras degraded from high gods into cosmic demons, and with Riti or Ahi, the battles fought between stars and constellations, between moon and planets, later on incarnated as kings and mortals. Hence also the war in heaven of Michael and his host against the dragon, Jupiter, and Lucifer, Venus, when a third of the stars of the rebellious host was hurled down into space and, quote, its place was found no more into heaven. And said long ago, quote, this is the basic and fundamental stone of the secret cycles.
Thank you, Magda. So first, the struggle for existence and the survival of the fittest reigned supreme the moment that cosmos manifested into being and could hardly escape the observant eye of the ancient sages. But as stated in the Secret Doctor Dialogues, the quality of enmity in this struggle is only present in the lower quaternary, not on causal levels. And she indicates that here when she says, from the moment the cosmos manifested into being, and through manifestation, that sets this quality for existence into play. Next, hence the incessant fights of Indra, the god of the firmament, with the Asuras, degraded from high gods into cosmic demons, and with Vriti or Ahi. So degraded from high gods into cosmic demons references the idea of demon est deus inversus, or the fall of the angels, which HBB describes as at great length a few pages back. Indra is the king of the gods, the lord of thunder and rain, therefore very Zeus-like, and you know, belonging to the fifth root race as a result, and the protector of the cosmic order. Asuras, in this reversed and thus exoteric depiction, are the enemies of the gods who challenge Indra's authority and try to disrupt his plans. In the esoteric version, asuras are the source and cause of the gods, as we were just talking about. There are numerous encounters. For example, in one battle, Indra fights against Vrita, a dragon-like asura who had swallowed the waters of the world and thus caused a great drought. Indra used his thunderbolt, Vajra, to slay Vritra and release the waters, restoring fertility and prosperity to the earth. These great sagas are externalizations of the inner battles between spirit and form that come to us all, really. You know, they're all these are, they're quite exoteric in their written form, but there is, there are secret schools connected, you know, in the great cultures that where these stories appear, that give the true meaning, that unveil the blinds and show the true meaning. Next, the battles fought between stars and constellations, between moon and planets, later on incarnated as kings and mortals. In Greek mythology, Orion was a great hunter who boasted that he could kill any animal on earth. He was challenged by a scorpion sent by Gaia, the goddess of the earth, who stung him to death.
Oh my God.
Somebody needs to mute. Zeus placed both Orion and the scorpion in the sky as constellations, but on opposite sides, so they would never meet again. It's just an example of the battles fought between stars and constellations. In Chinese mythology, Hu Yi was a legendary archer who shot down 9 of the 10 suns that scorched the earth. He was rewarded by the Jade Emperor with a pill of immortality, but his wife, stole it and flew to the moon, where she became the goddess of the moon. Her name is Chang'e. Hu Yi pursued her, but was stopped by the sun, who became his enemy. Hu Yi then built a palace on the sun, and he and his wife became rulers of the day and night. You know, you can imagine the esoteric meaning behind this. There's so much reference to esoteric thought in the myth. Next, hence also the war in heaven of Michael and his host against the dragon, who is Jupiter and Lucifer, Venus, when a third of the stars of the Brow, excuse me a moment. A third of the stars of the rebellious host was hurled down into space, and its place was found no more in heaven. So by far the fiercest example of daemon es deus in verses, of the reversal of the sacred and profane, is the Christian story of the fallen angels, wherein Jupiter and Venus are rendered as dark powers. the ancient serpent or dragon, also called the devil and Satan, leads a rebellion of fallen angels against God and his faithful angels in heaven. The dragon is identified with both the planet Jupiter and with Lucifer, Venus, the morning star that fell from grace in Isaiah 14:12. In the story, Michael, the archangel who commands the army of God and fights against the dragon and his followers, is the protector of Israel and the leader of the heavenly host. He is associated with the planet Mercury and also with the sun. In this Christian version of the war in heaven, there is a fierce and decisive battle that results in the defeat and expulsion of the dragon and his angels from heaven. They are cast down to earth, where they continue to deceive and persecute the people of God, but will be ultimately defeated and thrown into a lake of fire. In truth, there are two dragons, the lower representing the duality and separative forces of materiality, and the higher, the forces of revelation that compel us towards unity. Finally, as said long ago, this is the basic and fundamental stone of the secret cycles. This refers to the war in heaven, no matter through which culture it is depicted. The fundamental stone means that it is the recurring theme, the allegory for creation. Okay, thoughts or questions about this passage? In many ways, this is just an overview of different cultures and the stories that represent the creation and destruction cycle. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Anne Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Okay. It shows that the Brahmins and Tanamin speculated on the creation and development of the world quite in a Darwinian way, both anticipating him and his schools in the natural selection of species, the survival of the fittest, and transformation. There were old worlds that perished, conquered by the news, etc., etc. Isis unveiled. The assertion that all the worlds, stars, planets, etc., as soon as a nucleus of primordial substance in the Laya, undifferentiated state, is informed by the freed principles of a just, deceased, sidereal body, becomes first comets and then suns to cool down to inhabitable worlds, is a teaching as old as the rishis. Thus, the secret book distinctly teach, as we see, an astronomy that would not be rejected even by modern speculation, could the latter thoroughly understand its teaching.
Thank you, Anne Veronica. Okay, first, shows that the Brahmins and Tanaim speculated on the creation and development of the world quite in a Darwinian way, both anticipating him and his school in the natural selection of species, the survival of the fittest, and transformation. So the Tanaim were proponents of Jewish oral law that lived from approximately the time of Christ until around 220 AD. HPB's use of the term Darwinian way references, of course, survival of the fittest in the manifested world, not on causal levels. I think her point here is just that Darwin's thoughts were anticipated in many ancient cultures. Next, there were old worlds that perished, conquered by the new, and she gives this Isis Unveiled reference. The above quote does not appear in Isis Unveiled, Volume 2, but there is an interesting quote on page 421 on this same subject. Could we get a reader, please?
Rudy, can you read that for us, please?
The introductory chapters of Genesis were never meant to present even the remote allegory of the creation of our Earth. They embrace a metaphysical conception of some indefinite period in the eternity, when successive attempts were being made by the law of evolution at the formation of universes. This idea is plainly stated in the Zohar. There were old worlds which perished as soon as they came into existence, were formless, and were called sparks. Thus the smith, when hammering the iron, lets the sparks fly in all directions. The sparks are the primordial worlds which could not continue, because the sacred age, Sephira, had not yet as yet assumed its form of androgyny, or opposite sexes, of king and queen, Sephira and Katmon, and the master was not yet at his work. Isis Unveiled, page 421.
So this is, you know, a poetic way of saying that until the time is right, the cycles have to line up, or these, and there may be like miscarriages, even at a planetary level, that don't take because they're not aligned with the right cycle. Seems to be what's being described here. Okay, next. The assertion that all the worlds, stars, planets, etc., as soon as a nucleus of primordial substance in the Leia, and differentiated state, is informed by the freed principles of a just deceased sidereal body, become first comets and then suns to cool down to inhabitable worlds, is a teaching as old as the Rishis. An old commentary from a bit later in the Secret Doctrine describes this evolution more fully. Can we get a reader? And by the way, the bracketed comments are from HBB. They're HBBs. So it's just an old commentary with HBB's thoughts in brackets. Can we get a reader, please?
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
I'm having trouble with my headset, sorry. Okay, I'm going to read. From the one life, formless and uncreated, proceeds the universe of lives. First was manifested from the deep, chaos, cold, luminous fire, gaseous light, which formed the curds in space, irresolvable nebula, perhaps. These fought when a great heat was developed by the encountering and collision, which produced rotation. Then came the first manifested material, fire, hot flames, the wanderers in heaven, comets. Heat generates moist vapor that forms solid water. Then dry mist, then liquid mist, watery, that puts out the luminous brightness of the pilgrims, comets, and forms solid watery wheels, matter glow. Bhumi, Earth, hears with six sisters. They produce by their continuous motion an inferior fire, heat, and an aqueous mist, which yields the third world element, water. And from the breath of all, atmospheric air is born. These four are the four lives of the first four periods, rounds of Manvantara. The three last will follow.
Thank you, Biel. So this is a much more complete exegesis on the unfoldment of creation on a material level, right? And she gives us a hint here at the end that the description is an unfoldment of the first four rounds, which suggests that it is very specific to how our Earth's chain in its first four rounds has come into being. Okay. All right. Like I said, this section of the Secret Doctrine seems to be more like an overview of these ideas rather than a deep dive. This is on page 250. We're on 201, where clearly she gets more into it. Okay, next up. Thus, the secret books distinctly teach, as we see, an astronomy that would not be rejected even by modern speculation could the latter thoroughly understand its teachings, the latter being astronomy. So before modern astronomy will be able to accept such teachings, they will need to see and accept the fact of causal existence. The secret books have existed in every age, known and studied by initiates, but hidden from the unready and those that would misuse the teachings. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Should I?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
For archaic astronomy and the ancient physical and mathematical sciences express views identical with those of modern science, and many of far more momentous import. A struggle for life as a survival of the fittest in the worlds above, as on our planet here below, are distinctly taught. This teaching, however, although it would not be entirely rejected by science, is sure to be repudiated as an integral whole, for it avers that there are only seven self-born primordial gods emanated from the Trinitarian One. In other words, it means that all the worlds or sidereal bodies, always on strict analogy, are formed one from the other after the primordial manifestation at the beginning of the great age is accomplished. The birth of the celestial bodies in space is compared to a crowd or multitude of pilgrims at the festival of the fires. Seven ascetics appear on the threshold of the temple with seven lighted sticks of incense. At the light of these, the first row of pilgrims light their incense sticks.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, so first, for archaic astronomy and the ancient physical and mathematical sciences express views identical with those of modern science, and many of far more momentous import. So in particular, both ancient and modern astronomy agree that the sun and the planets formed through a gradual aggregation of particles. Also, the fact of a heliocentric solar system, though lost in the Middle Ages, was known to the ancient. There's a number of surviving manuscripts that indicate this. The views of the quote-unquote far more momentous import would include an awareness of causal levels of the formation process, which is, you could say, in the same way that the idea of the of the sun being at the center of the solar system was lost during the Middle Ages, that the idea that there are causal levels has been lost by modern science. Okay, I saw a hand go up.
Yes, I'm wondering if Darwin was right with his survival of the fittest, and let's say Rousseau, the philosopher that theorized the good savage philosophy, meaning everybody is born good, you know, and why and who brought about this false narration in that then became also science. So wrong philosophy and wrong science. If PHB confirmed all, you know, and is telling us that even science would confirm, and even, you know, say more. But who hijacked all this, you know, constantly, and why, you know, how also, you know, why? It's all like coded in this sugar good savage philosophy concept. And, you know, so on this basis, who is going to keep on hijacking this, and how is this possible? Like what, poisons, you know, like poisons, like in the Buddhic meaning, in the Oriental meaning, are still like asphyxiating us still on this round and planet, you know, with all the eight sphere matter that, you know, we are facing.
Yeah, well, it comes from nihilists, from personality-based philosophy, which tries unsuccessfully to find cause in personality activity. And, you know, psychology has been largely built around this idea, as well as much modern philosophy. You know, you have to go back a bit in order to find causal roots to expressed in both philosophy and psychology. And I think, you know, it was a mass movement towards the loss of an understanding of the divine. I think that happened as a failure of the church, you know, which was dominant in the West. And it was, you know, there were so many misinterpretations in the church doctrine, and what was asked by the church was rejected by so many people that they turned to physical science and to personality psychology, personality-based psychology and philosophy. And we have, you know, a library full of books written from those perspectives.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we are coming up to the end, and I think rather than go ahead, we'll get an announcement of dates. Let's look at the chats here real quick.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. That's rare today. The next webinar, of course, is going to be Treatise on Cosmic Fire, and that's going to be on 26 July. Then the next one after that will be The Secret Teaching of All Ages on 4 August, and the next Secret Doctrine is going to be 25 August.
Great, thank you. I want to read this comment from Martha Dalhue. After the Enlightenment, when disciplines became siloed, information became fractionalized. It was one of the factors that produced extreme forms of materialistic thinking. Thank you, Martha. It was no one person, but a stage in human development where now, because of the breakdown of the environment, the tendency toward becoming more interdisciplinary thought is growing. Yeah, good thoughts.
Sorry for the grammar.
Yeah, no sweat.
To put big thoughts.
Yeah. Okay, you all, we'll see you hopefully on Friday. That's our next webinar, Treatise on Cosmic Fire. So take care. Thanks for participating. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Goodbye, everybody.